From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. The debate over the Islamic Cultural Center being built two blocks from Ground Zero in Manhattan has focused conversation on religious freedom and tolerance. Today we get an Iowa Muslim perspective from Taha Tawil, the imam for the Mother Mosque of America, which has been part of Cedar Rapids since 1934. Then in our second half hour, a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Marilyn Robinson of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. In her new book, Absence of Mind, she takes up the religion versus science debate, challenging those who crusade against religion under the banner of science. That's all coming up this hour. First, the news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The proposed Islamic Cultural Center in Lower Manhattan has generated fierce debate, with ripples going far beyond New York City to the rest of the country. Many conservative politicians and people see the project as an offense to the nearly 3,000 people killed when Islamist militant suicide hijackers from Al-Qaeda slammed planes into the Twin Towers. Others say the center should be allowed to be built as a statement of the religious freedom and tolerance upon which this country was founded. Some Republicans running for midterm elections around the United States have used the project as a campaign issue after national conservatives Newt Gingrich and Sarah Palin announced their opposition. Representative Steve King of Iowa's 5th District used Twitter to say the Ground Zero Mosque must be blocked by public rejection and asked in the same tweet, "Are we wimps?" This first half hour, we want to get an Iowa Muslim perspective on the debate. My guest for this first half hour is Imam Taha Tawil, director of the Mother Mosque of America in Cedar Rapids, which has been part of Cedar Rapids since 1934, and it's recognized as the first mosque built for Muslims in America. Imam Taha Tawil, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you, sir.
Before we have you give us your perspective about the proposed Islamic Center near Ground Zero in New York City, I'd like to ask you a few things about your mosque in Cedar Rapids, the Mother Mosque of America, because I think many of our listeners may be surprised to learn it's been in Cedar Rapids so long, since 1934, and as recognized as the first mosque built for Muslims in America. How did it come to be located in Cedar Rapids?
Well, it happened to be here because of early Arab Christian moved from what we call today Lebanon and settled in the city here. And it happens that a lot of Muslims came after that and settled in Cedar Rapids because of its farmland, because of its good people, and because of the freedom that they have.
How large is the Islamic community in Cedar Rapids?
We are talking about a couple of thousand of families.
Mm-hmm. Why is your mosque called the Mother Mosque of America?
Because of the fact that it was from the ground up built. It was built specifically as a mosque, as a cultural center. And this was the idea in their mind, those early settlers and immigrants to this country. And later on, we found that there was earlier mosques, but not from the ground up. It was on the second floor, or it was on above a restaurant or a grocery store where they use a room for prayers. But that's why the Mother Mosque have this name or title, because it was from the ground up.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe the structure for us?
Well, it's a small structure. It's like a schoolhouse, I will say 30 by 55 feet, and it has two stores. The basement, or the first floor, we call the cultural center, where we have the social aspects of the families, comes every week having a social time and enjoying the company of each other. And then when time for the prayers, they go to the upstairs, in which the prayer room is there, library, and many, many educational things in the prayer area.
Imam Taha Tawil, can I ask where you're from, how you came to the Cedar Rapids Mosque?
Well, I am from Jerusalem, and I came way back in 1983, and I visited my brother in Chicago, and he took me to the American Islamic College in Chicago, where I found that, you know, Islam is progressing and spreading. And they asked me to serve as an imam in Iowa because the imam in Iowa left to the Soviet Union at that time, which we called, and so he could not come back, and they were in need of an imam, where Dr. T.B. Irving or Thomas Irving was serving on the board in Cedar Rapids, and they explained to me how important that mosque is.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I came in.
Were you surprised at that time? You remember being surprised that Iowa, not exactly a poster child for diversity in the United States, I guess, would have such a large Islamic community in Cedar Rapids.
Yes, I really was surprised. And I am sorry to say that Iowa is not famous, you know, like in New York or like Florida or... You know, in the Middle East, we just know Chicago, New York, but we don't know those, you know, other states. But also another thing happened, that the state Iowa means in Arabic, yes. And so when they asked me, where am I? I said, I am in Iowa. They said, yes, we know you are in America, but where at? And so it was great to and honor to stay since that time till now in the state of Iowa.
Has the mosque in Cedar Rapids, to your knowledge, in its history, going back to 1934, gone through periods of controversy when perhaps at its founding that some people were against it in some way?
I don't think so. I was told by members of the community that this mosque was always open to the public, and the support comes from our local people, where we sell Middle Eastern dinars, where we have fundraise, and these people help us buying, you know, these things. And the Christian Arabs and the Muslim Arabs have been in town as one family. In fact, I was told by members of the community that when St. George Church, the Orthodox St. George, was erected in Cedar Rapids, Muslim ladies were there in the kitchen helping to sell fatayer and baklava and other Middle Eastern food. And later on, those Christian ladies came also to help the Muslim ladies at which we called Muslim Temple at that time, or An-Nadi. The name of it was An-Nadi, which represent a club or a social gathering beside the religious function.
So it sounds like the Christian Arabs and the Muslim Arabs in Cedar Rapids may have something to teach by example to the Christian and Muslim Arabs back in the Middle East.
I am sure the Muslim and the Christian Arabs have a good relation, and I was, as I said, from Jerusalem, and we never have a problem within ourselves there. It was always as a family, as neighbors, as people coexist with each other. It's just politics,
mm-hmm.
I think, what divide people.
Now,
but, yes.
Excuse me, Imam Taha Tawil, was there any negative reaction directed toward the mosque or the Muslim community in Cedar Rapids immediately after 9/11?
No. In fact, there was a lot of support for the Mother Mosque because, as I said, the Mother Mosque is an American entity and it is a historical site. and it goes way back to the early 1900s. And so I found some flowers on the steps of the mosque after September 11. I found many letters came in support, knowing that we are not like those radical people outside or those cults who are trying to terrorize other people. And people in Iowa really distinguish between a cult, a violent entity, and a peaceful entity.
Let's shift our focus to the Ground Zero controversy we've been hearing about, the structure proposed two blocks from Ground Zero in Manhattan,
yes,
described in various ways in the media as a mosque, as an Islamic cultural center, or as both, as an Islamic cultural center and a mosque. What is the definition of a mosque? Is this a mosque?
No, it's not. This is a center, and the center normally carried the definition of dual functions, social function, educational function, beside the religious function. So when you say a center, you mean a babysitting, a recreation, a kitchen, a hall for wedding, for funerals.
Mm-hmm.
You mean so much beside all of that.
But can it contain a mosque as well, because there is a place foreseen for prayer, devoted to prayer?
Exactly. And then it will have the prayer area, and that's why we call the Qurtuba Islamic Center is a great idea to promote peace and understanding and to defeat those radicals who happen to mess with our character and our personality.
So what is your reaction to the uproar over the proposed center in New York City? What is driving it? You mentioned politics a few seconds ago.
I really feel that there is no issue in a way to make this big thing about it. I feel that this is part of our freedom. This is part of our constitution. And this is what makes America great, you know, with its diversity, with its cultural issues. And I really feel that those who is taking it, they are misinformed, or they are carrying this the premise that they are driving themselves on is a wrong one. We are not part of Al-Qaeda. We don't know them. We have nothing to do with what they are doing, and we are against them. We are voicing, saying, here, we are Americans, this is our freedom, and we worship our Lord, our God, the way that the Christian and Jews and others are worshiping.
Imam Taha Tawil, we'll have to take a short break. Please stay with us. The director of the Mother Mosque of America in Cedar Rapids, it's been there since 1934. You can join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, back in 60 seconds. Great to have you with us on The Exchange here on Iowa Public Radio's news stream. I'm Ben Kiefer over the noon hour. Coming up in about 15 minutes, a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Marilyn Robinson of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Her new book, Absence of Mind, she takes up in that work the religion versus science debate, challenging those who crusade against religion under the banner of science. Right now, we're talking about the proposed Islamic Cultural Center in Lower Manhattan and the fierce debate that has resulted from that, rippling far beyond New York City to the rest of the country. My guest, Imam Taha Tawil, director of the Mother Mosque of America in Cedar Rapids, which has been part of Cedar Rapids since 1934. I wonder, have you discussed this controversy, since it's been so much in the news, in your mosque? Have you made it a point of discussion, Imam?
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. Especially we are in the month of Ramadan, and normally we have 90 prayers. And after the 90 prayers, we have some break where we discuss issues of concerns. And I did speak vividly to the community that this Qurtuba Islamic Center came from the city of Cordoba in Spain, in which there the history tells us that there was the peak of understanding and knowledge came through the community by cooperating. Jewish scholars, Christian scholars, Muslim scholars used to work together to enhance our living, to enhance our education, science, and so on. And this Qurtuba Islamic Center is part of that legend. It's part of that vision that we see that the Abrahamic faith and their children should come back together on a table where we can show in an exhibition that we are not far away from Judaism or Christianity, and vice versa. We teach also the Muslims that our neighbors, the Christian and the Jews, also like everyone else, have faith and they believe in God and so on. So it was just a matter of education, discussion, and showing that why they oppose, you know, this proposal.
Mm-hmm. In talking with the members of your Islamic community in Cedar Rapids, what seems to be troubling the people in your Muslim community the most about this controversy, the discussion in the media and so forth?
Well, the distinguished between a cult like Hitler. Hitler, if he was a Christian, then what he did is not a Christianity. The Mafia, if the Mafia is a Catholic entity, then the Catholic is not a faith. And the same thing, Ibn Laden, if he is Islam, then Islam is a violent religion. And Baruch Goldstein, also the same, cannot represent the Jewish extremists. So we are discussing and showing that as rational, as people of education, we must be together to face this issue and build the trust. This is what America is all about. The State Department, when they send visitors to the Mother Mosque, we teach them this is the symbolic of the freedom of religion that we have.
Mm-hmm.
It is the founder fathers who gave us that right, and this is what, you know, if you take that right from us, I am sure things will not look the same.
While you have that right, they have that right in New York City. This is, I understand, private ground upon which this Islamic Cultural Center will be built. Do you understand the argument that it is just insensitive, as they say, the argument goes, to put it so close to ground zero?
Yes, I understood their argument. I feel that they missed the point. We are Americans. We lost people in New York like any other faith. We have a lot of people in the Army, in the Marines, and we serve the country like every other nationality. And at the same time, we are saying, as Americans, please understand that we want to defeat Al-Qaeda and we want to defeat those terrorist groups by allowing such monument and tower to be there in order to teach the right information, not the misled information or stereotypes or other things like that.
Sarah Palin, Newt Gingrich, a couple of the big names, strongly opposed to the proposed center, including also Iowa Republican Congressman Tom Latham and Steve King. They have also come out strongly against it. What words do you have for Iowa's elected representatives in Washington on this, who have come out against it?
Well, I will say that my neighbor, my fellow citizen, this is America. You have the right to protest. You have the right to oppose. But overall, me and you and everybody abide by the law. We are citizens, and there is a constitution that runs us all. And so we need to go back to basics and let everybody practice what he feels it is right. And I feel that those great figures, as you mentioned their names, they have a lot of good things to offer to the community and the Muslims also who are in support and the other people who are in support of this project, they also have a lot to offer to our great country.
As a representative of Islam in Iowa, as a leading figure, a Muslim figure in Iowa, have you reached out to any politicians representing us in Washington?
Well, the community members did, yes, and we have contacted many of our representatives, and there are communication with them. But on a personal level, I was with the churches, I was talking to the rabbi here in town, and we have the Interreligious Council, who are also supporting and sending a letter of support. Even the Gazette of our city here, the newspaper, also they have last week editorial also in support of it. So we feel that we are in a good hand, and the good thing will prevail. And I just pray for all those who do not see our viewpoint or this issue to be open in their vision and in their mind, and to go ahead with what the rationale and the reason is saying.
Imam Tawil, we have just a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about the Mother Mosque of America and the aftermath of the floods of 2008. Your mosque was affected. How was it affected, and how's the recovery going?
Well, sir, I want you to understand that this is a great catastrophe that the state of Iowa, and especially the city of Cedar Rapids, we have a lot of damage and we have a lot of things that we lost, but we gain the community back. We were cooperating with each other, and the one who came to clean the Mother Mosque and to help the Mother Mosque was the Christians, Jews, Buddhists, and many other faith groups came on our aid. And if I may just allow me to say one thing before we end here about the community needs to be together, and the government is doing their best to keep each one's right in the right place. We don't want to split. We don't want to create nonsense, as they say. I heard some burning of Quran coming up. I heard some extreme militia Christian trying to protect that church and others. We don't want that. I don't think this is the right approach for our neighbors, for our fellow citizens. And we have rights as well as everything else. So I want to ask everybody to pray for peace and harmony for our great country.
Imam Taha Tawil, we'll end it there. Thank you for those final words and this conversation this half hour. Director of the Mother Mosque of America in Cedar Rapids, thank you, Imam, for joining us.
Thank you, sir, for allowing me to be on your program.
Imam Taha Tawil, Director of the Mother Mosque of America in Cedar Rapids. If you caught part of that conversation, you want to hear the rest of it in its entirety, you can always go to iowapublicradio.org, look for The Exchange under our program section, hear that in its entirety. Coming up in our second half hour of The Exchange, a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Marilyn Robinson of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. In her new book, Absence of Mind, she takes up the religion versus science debate, challenging those who crusade against religion under the banner of science. That's coming up in just a few minutes. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest is Marilyn Robinson, a professor at the renowned University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. In 2005, Robinson won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction for her novel Gilead. Her latest book, a work of nonfiction, weighs in on the battle between science and religion. It's called Absence of Mind, The Dispelling of Inwardness from the Modern Myth of the Self. I began our recent conversation by asking her to sum up the goal of the book.
Well, I suppose a major objective of mine was to make the distinction between arguments that are made with the claim of scientific authority behind them and science itself. I don't think that there is any necessary conflict between science and religion. And I think that a lot of the supposed science that is used as if it were in conflict with religion is not good science, and that the distinction is very much in need of being made.
Mm-hmm. How do you tell the difference between the science that works for you, that fits, that is not in conflict, and the other sort of science that may mesh with these other evaluations of life, other ways of looking at life?
Well, a standard for me is whether or not the science that is being proposed or whatever is being proposed as science actually takes into account what science has been for the last 100 years, you know, since basically quantum theory rose, you know, we began to have a sophisticated idea of the complexity of physical reality and so on. The kind of, you know, quote-unquote science, I call it parascience in the book, that typically is not the work of physicists or mathematicians or any of the other people that do theoretical work that would be, you know, cutting edge, but are more typically animal anthropologists or, you know, people in fields that are, one would say, marginally scientific, I think, from a scientist's point of view, in the sense that the findings are anecdotal and can't be reproduced. I mean, it's as if they take the authority that science has from its, you know, its ethic of self-criticism and self-correction, and they claim it even though they themselves typically are not people who practice sciences that can abide by this ethic, you know.
Can you give me an example that comes to mind for you of what you just mentioned?
Well, I mean, one of the problems for me is seeing someone who has made a very considerable study of insects proceed from that to statements about the nature of the cosmos, you know?
E.O. Wilson?
E.O. Wilson, yes, exactly. But Steven Pinker is a sort of a linguist, apparently. And on the basis of that, you know, I mean, it's, you can't simply say the word science and on the basis of that have the methodology that would allow you to make the kinds of statements that they make and that they insist on.
You mentioned experimental psychologist Steven Pinker a number of times in your book. To quote, you quote him as saying, how does the spook interact with solid matter? How does an ethereal nothing respond to flashes, pokes and peeps and beeps and get arms and legs to move? Your response to that is?
Well, I mean, that it's based on a very primitive notion of a sort of dichotomy between the physical and the non-physical. And, of course, he would disallow the existence of the non-physical, you know. But basically, we have the fact that a process we can't describe, which we call consciousness, does indeed, you know, control our bodies, our whole physicality with an extraordinary degree of consistency and detail, you know. Mm-hmm. If you think of the body as a lump of meat, you know, and the soul as some sort of, you know, epiphenomenal whatever, you know.
And the mind is a lump of pudding or something.
Exactly. But in fact, you know, the deeper you go into the physicality of a human being or an animal, the more profoundly complex and mysterious the functioning of the physical body becomes. And this kind of dismissive treatment of physicality, you know, I mean, and its isolation as one form of being rather than as one expression of the energy that is all being, that's kind of medieval, you know?
So how do we measure the non-physical nature of the mind? How should we look at that when Steven Pinker discounts the non-physical?
Well, you know, again, we have this problem of what is physicality and what is non-physicality. The mind, so far as we can know, is generated out of the activity of neurons and so on, you know. What are they, you know? I mean, at how do they function in the way that they function? If you were to you know, you say, I just read a book that said, how do unconscious neurons generate consciousness, you know? Who knows what a neuron is? Nobody knows what it is. It is one of the things that generates consciousness. That's all we know, you know?
But maybe someday we will know.
Absolutely. And I think we will know faster and better if we drop assumptions about categorical differences between, say, the mind and the brain.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm getting you right in your book, too, you're saying the result of this sort of science is an absence of mind?
Well, first, I think these things are kind of opportunistically associated with each other. I don't think there's any intrinsic necessity for the exclusion of the idea of mind, which, you know, like the philosopher John Searle talks about this, what you have to do to persuade people that they have, you know, of course they have minds and so does everybody else. This is a primary human self-intuition and intuition of other people, you know. The exclusion of it doesn't seem to me to be necessary. It doesn't seem to me to be, you know, a religious as opposed to a non-religious difference. I think that atheists are also very aware of having minds, you know,
mm-hmm.
Enjoying them, etc. I don't know where this comes from, but it is something that has come down through a particular tradition of thought that has claimed the authority of science historically, you know, but nevertheless has that as a sort of an extraneous feature.
Mm-hmm. And so this war, so to speak, between religion and science is completely unnecessary.
Yes, I would say that. And I think that if there were a scientific argument against religion, a real one, I mean, one that actually embraces what we can hypothesize now about the nature of being and so on, that would be a very interesting thing. If someone could make an argument from first-rate science, it would be very clarifying, you know. But what we have is argument made against something that really, I think, doesn't deserve to be called science.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, I'm talking with Marilynne Robinson. The Absence of Mind is her latest book, a work of nonfiction, The Dispelling of Inwardness from the Modern Myth of the Self, just published by Yale University Press, a book that looks at how we think about the mind and consciousness, weighs in on, as we just talked about, the science versus religion battle. Marilynne Robinson, one thing that the mind has when we study it is a difference from all other aspects of things on this planet or our bodies. We study the mind. We have to use our minds to study the object of study.
Mm-hmm.
So what challenges does that present? And that is a crux of a problem here, isn't it?
It's a huge and interesting problem, no question about it. I have read people who say that the brain is too complex for the brain to understand, you know. I mean, and it's not uncommon, you know, in scientific magazines and so on to come across this statement that the human brain is the most complex object known to exist in the universe. You know, which is quite a distinction, I think, you know, quite a wonderful thing. I think that there's a sort of impatience in the idea that a deeper understanding will be immediately available. It won't be, you know, but the problem is profoundly interesting. And I think that the attempt to kind of hasten the conclusion leads to a lot of bad thinking.
Hasten the conclusion of what the mind is and isn't?
Yes, exactly.
How processes happen.
And what what kind of a phenomenon it is, you know, because I think that one of the temptations of this kind of dismissing of the mind that I talk about is that it simply makes things much simpler. If you don't have to encounter the actual complexity of what a human being is, then you can have the illusion of understanding a human being much more readily.
So let's take an example of something that's perhaps inexplicable, maybe you can explain them, in the mind. Emotions. Why have them? What use are they?
They're just a given of our reality. I mean, you know why?
We are animals. Why are they given to us as animals and perhaps not to other animals?
Well, I think that in the course of underestimating ourselves, we've underestimated a lot of other creatures beside. I think animals can be highly emotional, in fact. But if you consider that, I mean, you know, if you take an old model of human experience, which sees us as sort of the, you know, King Lear on the heath, you know, with the interior weather and the exterior weather somehow in conversation with each other, you know, if you think of the emotional existence of a human being as the drama of an existence, you know, of a then I think, you know, I mean, this is what I think has been acknowledged, you know, in music and everything else for forever and ever, you know, the externalization of the passions of the self, you know. There is a kind of mind, there has been for generations, that does not find that beautiful.
I want to talk about some of the areas perhaps where your work may have some comment about some of the hot spots that we're experiencing when we turn on the news, we listen to the news, read the news. What does your work here have to say about human origins and the debate we have about human origins?
Well, I think that I sort of don't understand that. I mean, I think that it's been
the debate.
The debate. It's been used polemically on one side of the argument, and it's been, the other side of the argument for the people who feel that it is an argument have been very much thrown off balance by it, you know, I think, and have become acting more like people who are embattled than people that are actually, you know, looking at the argument in a more rational and dispassionate way. I think that there's a great deal that's described by evolutionary theory as it exists, which is, it's quite a modest theory in its present form. I think that it is probably inadequate too.
Mm-hmm.
Like everything else, it's the whole question is simply something to be looked at. And the best suggestions that can be found are to be valued.
Mm-hmm. I know that you are a person of faith, so how can evolution be reconciled with faith?
Well, it's an article of my own personal faith that I don't have to tell God how things had to happen. If he was pleased to evolve things, that's fine with me.
You are a member of the Congregational Church of Christ in Iowa City. In fact, I understand that sometimes you preach at your church. How we think about the mind make a difference when we choose to have a faith, we have a faith, or we don't have a faith?
Well, for my purposes, you know, theological thinking is a huge framework for everything else that I think about. And I don't know how other people use their minds or what they find useful as instruments of their thinking. But for me, it supplies me with a very, very large conceptual world that I enjoy and feel continuously instructed by.
How long have you been fascinated by this topic of the mind, what it is, what it's for, how it works?
In a way, I think, you know, I probably always have, partly because I think writers tend to be, because they're drawing on it continuously, you know, mm-hmm. and they notice association and memory and all those kinds of things, that the mind is so fertile, you know. And so there's a kind of a consciousness of the inward life, I think, that a writer almost inevitably feels. When I first started writing, I thought, how do we know? How can I convey to someone else an experience that is mine and not hers or his? And then I thought, well, of course, metaphor, you know, that's how you do it. It's like this, it's like that, you know. And you consult your memory and you find that all these kind of associative patterns are the language of the mind, you know. And it's really interesting and beautiful, and it has been preoccupation of mine for decades.
We have such a fast-paced life, many of us do. It's sometimes hard work to slow the pace down. I think you'll agree with that. And when you're talking about memory and what you remember from your life, it's always a fascinating idea to think about how our minds record things. Do they record every little minutia of every second of our lives, you think? As a writer, that's an important question.
Well, I don't know. One of the things that has been very striking to me is that if I make a certain kind of demand of my memory, it will respond, and it might take a long time.
So it's there. It's just a matter of access.
Well, whatever I basically need from it or whatever it feels like offering me, you know, there's a lot there. There's no question. When I was writing Housekeeping, I was living in France, and I was writing about Northern Idaho, where I had not lived for years at that time. And I would think, you know, what would grow in such and such a place, or what, you know, these things would come back, you know, come floating up in my mind. It was really, it was the first time I really realized that you're mind is much more capacious than your consciousness is.
I wonder if your work on the mind has anything to say about mental health or mental illness, when things go very right with the mind, when you have a very satisfying, joyous life and a lot of study of happiness in recent times, as opposed to just studying the mental illness.
Right. I think... I'm speaking completely outside any area of competence that I have, so I will continue. But I do think that the mind is probably the most enjoyable aspect of life under all the best circumstances, and that the more people cultivate it as a thing to be enjoyed, even in its oddnesses and even in its melancholies, I think if people could be more trusting of their minds, that might be something that would enhance. But
How have you changed in the way you treat your mind, observe your own mind when you go into a dark corner?
Well, you know, I mean, partly going into a dark corner is something that's not rare for someone in my line of work, first of all. And there are a lot of dark corners where I've learned to feel rather at home at this point. And that changes the nature of the experience.
Mm-hmm. In a chapter on Freud in your book, you write about how Sigmund Freud contributed to the absence of mind. Can you clarify that?
Well, what he does is create a very, very generic model of the mind. There is very little notice of the fact that people would be individualized in any essential way. And I think that there probably are historical reasons for his insistence on that. But nevertheless, the implication is that the mind tends to run on dark, on bad energy, you know, that it has irreconcilable conflicts that it inherits from time out of mind, and that its emotions are basically presented to it as a problem of control, you know, suppression.
Mm-hmm.
And there is just no, I mean, you know, the mind is something that is positive, energetic, culturally enriched, socially fascinated, all those things. You really can't find any place in them for them in Freudian understanding.
You were at work on another book. It's about the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to focus on there?
Well, I want to restore the sense of the Bible as a literature, you know. I mean, the way that the Bible's been studied, especially the Old Testament, but both of them really, for the last 150 years, there's been a tendency to sort of dismember the text and attribute it to a variety of writers with a variety of, you know, whatever, local political concerns and so on. And the effect of all that has been really to make it unreadable from the point of view of anybody who reads it through that lens. This is, you know, the sort of intellectual tradition of biblical literacy has been very much influenced by the tendency to make it in basically an incoherent text, you know. And then you have, on the other hand, a sort of wildly simplistic readings, you know. But there is no reading of the Bible in the way that you would have found it for Milton or Melville, where it's a great, bold, coherent literature. And I would like to restore that.
Pulitzer Prize-winning author Marilyn Robinson. Her latest book is called Absence of Mind, The Dispelling of Inwardness from the Modern Myth of the Self. The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.